20-2781 from the Western District of Arkansas, United States versus Jay Thompson.
All right, Mr. Holt, we'll hear from you first.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Aaron Holt, and I represent the appellant in this case, Jay Thompson. Mr. Thompson has argued to this court that insufficient evidence was presented at trial to support his conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. The main issue I want to emphasize regarding this argument is that it is undisputed that Detective Allison Nguyen, who was 28 years old at the time of trial, sent two photos of herself to Mr. Thompson, one of them to which he'd applied a filter, one of them apparently completely unaltered. And Thompson testified he believed these photos to depict a grown woman, not a minor. And indeed, it is undisputed that they did depict a grown woman in her late 20s. We also discussed a number of other factors that we believe should have given rise to reasonable doubt in the mind of a reasonable juror as to Mr. Thompson's guilt.
Did your client say during the interview with the agents that he believed she was under the age of 16?
That is what Agent Faulkner testified to at trial, Your Honor. We acknowledge that.
Well, if the jury believed that testimony, why isn't that one step towards sufficient evidence, even though your client denied it at trial?
Well, Your Honor, again, the main thing that I'm pointing out is the evidence that was introduced and not not disputed by the government that there were these photos that were actually of a woman who was in her late 20s.
Did the jury see the photos?
Your Honor, they did. They did see those photos.
So why couldn't they use the photos and the interview to discount his denial?
Well, Your Honor, obviously the jury did what it did, and the main point that really I want to emphasize in argument to this court is that Mr. Thompson has at the very least shown that the evidence was far from overwhelming, and most of the argument that I would like to present and that I anticipate the court might have questions about or might like to hear about was our alternative argument that Mr. Thompson is entitled to a new trial because of prosecutorial misconduct. If I may go on to that point, Mr. Thompson has argued that several instances of prosecutorial misconduct prejudiced his substantial rights and rendered his trial fundamentally unfair. We've acknowledged that no objection was made at trial to any of that conduct, and therefore plain error review applies. But we submit that the misconduct at issue here so fundamentally compromised the fairness of the jury trial that relief is warranted even under that very strict standard of review, as the error here seriously affects the fairness, integrity, and public reputation of judicial proceedings. The key evidentiary issue in this case was Mr. Thompson's...
We seem to get a lot of these appeals about prosecutorial misconduct with no objections made. Why do you suppose that is? You're an expert on this, being an assistant federal public defender. Is it that the lawyers aren't familiar with what misconduct is until they go back later and read the record, or things you should be objecting to in final argument, or are people afraid to object in final argument? I know it's not really part of the law of the case or anything, but I'm just wondering why it always comes up in this posture.
Your Honor, I can't speak directly to that in this particular case. I think that part of it may have to do with a reluctance to object during closing arguments. I think that may be part of it. I did not represent Mr. Thompson below. I looked at the record, and this is what I'm the appellate attorney on this one, so I don't know exactly what the thinking was.
All right. Well, go ahead and tell us why you think there was error.
Sure. The key evidentiary issue was Mr. Thompson's state of mind, what he thought about the age of the person he was communicating with. He said he thought he was communicating with a grown woman. Agent Faulkner said no. He confessed to us that he thought she was under 16. So the credibility of these two key witnesses was critical to the case. And the prosecutorial misconduct that we've complained of on appeal was aimed at damaging Mr. Thompson's credibility and at improperly bolstering Agent Faulkner's. So it went to that key issue. And I think one of the most important cases to look at here is this court's decision in United States versus Miller from 2010. This court held that even a single misstep on the part of the prosecutor may be so destructive of the right to a fair trial that reversal is mandated. In that case, the court identified two such missteps that warranted reversal for a new trial. The first one was that the prosecutor insinuated that to find the defendant innocent, the jury must believe that Officer Smith, in that case, was being dishonest. And the second one was that the prosecutor stated that an acquittal required the jury to find that Officer Smith would jeopardize his future career as a police officer. Those exact same missteps occurred in the instant case, only I would argue in a somewhat more prejudicial manner, plus three additional missteps. The prosecutor improperly asked Mr. Thompson if Agent Faulkner was lying, so compelled him to accuse a government agent of lying on the stand. The prosecutor asked Mr. Thompson on a couple of occasions if there was a government conspiracy against him and got him to say that, yes, I don't really know. It seems like there was. It feels like a witch hunt to me. That's what he ended up testifying to. And then the government also improperly appealed to the passion, prejudice, and sympathy of the jury by going even further and suggesting that if it were to vote to acquit Mr. Thompson, Agent Faulkner would lose his job and be prosecuted, and his family would be harmed. So all of these incidents occurred on the second day of a two-day trial, the same day the jury deliberated and found Mr. Thompson guilty of the offense charged. Each of these errors tended to compound and amplify the others. They're all somewhat related to each other. Things were referenced in closing that had been improperly elicited during the testimony phase of the trial. I believe the most prejudicial argument occurred in closing and rebuttal closing, right before the jury was sent to deliberate. The government has attempted to defend all of the prosecutor's conduct here as appropriate, and hasn't conceded, to my recollection, that any of its questioning or argument was improper. However, the government has failed to really cite any authority that affirmatively indicates that its challenged conduct was proper. A closer look at its brief suggests that the general thrust of its argument on appeal is really that any misconduct that occurred was harmless in light of the evidence presented at trial.
I know you cite Miller, but why is it improper to argue that false testimony by an officer, for example, could have a deleterious impact on his career? Why isn't that comparable to arguing that a cooperating defendant could face revocation of his plea agreement if he testifies falsely? Isn't the government allowed to counteract allegations of bias with information about incentives the witness might have to be truthful?
Your Honor, the cases that I've seen and that we cited on this do indicate that the government is entitled to make a fair response and rebuttal. But again, all the cases that we're pointing to tend to say that this is going too far. This is simply something that's going too far. The government is allowed to question and to make argument as to the lack of a motive to lie. But this is going even further than that by saying that, by arguing that there is this massive disincentive to lie. And I think one reason
my question is why, even if the cases say that, why is that correct?
Well, Your Honor, because it's something that is improperly vouching or bolstering, because it is implying a guarantee of truthfulness. It's trying to get the jury to think there's no way this person would lie because these consequences would follow, without any actual evidence as to how likely those consequences are to follow. And I think very importantly, without acknowledging that a government witness, just like any other witness, can be mistaken about something and can have a faulty recollection about something. This is kind of presenting to the jury that, you know, it's just promoting the government witness as somebody that's, you know, that's sort of above that sort of thing. It's taking the imprimatur of the government and you know, endowing the witness with it in a way that's improper. There are multiple cases that say that, including this court's prior precedent. I believe that the most harmful section of argument was in the rebuttal closing, right before this went to the jury, when the government communicated to the members of the jury that the only way they could acquit Mr. Thompson was to find that Agent Faulkner was lying and that there was a government conspiracy against him. And the government literally said that. The prosecutor literally said that twice. That you have to find, in order to acquit him, you have to find that Agent Faulkner was lying. You have to find there was a government conspiracy. They said that twice. And I just said it twice. I apologize. It's simply not true. That's simply not true. That while there may have been a direct conflict between their testimony, there was still the possibility that Agent Faulkner could have been mistaken. And so the government being allowed to present that to the jury to make the jury think that you know you have to find that this government agent was lying in order to acquit, and not allowing for the possibility that he could have been mistaken, I think that was very, very prejudicial. And again, even more than that, the prosecutor here drew the professional, personal, and legal repercussions into it. And so effectively, the argument was that if you do vote to acquit, that means you think he was lying, that means he loses his job, he's prosecuted, and his family is harmed. That's just putting something in the jury's mind that doesn't need to be in the jury's mind going into deliberations, when what needs to be there is, did the government prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt? Did they prove that, you know, Mr. Thompson's state of mind beyond a reasonable doubt in this case?
Counsel, how did defense counsel respond? I realize you were just discussing something in rebuttal argument right before the case goes to the jury. But as far as the earlier comments, how did defense counsel respond at all to the suggestions that, you know, being generous to your argument here, that police officers won't lie because they have too much to lose, and that you had to conclude that this officer, respectable officer, was lying? Was that addressed at all in defense counsel's closing?
It was, Judge Cobes, what the defense attorney argued in closing was that there were some things that he believed weighed on the credibility of the investigation as a whole, but also he very clearly argued, look, this could have been a mistake. This was a 2 to 3 minute interview that happened 5 months ago, where Agent Faulkner was not the one conducting the interview. He was filling out a consent to search form while Officer Sears was conducting the interview. He pointed out that, look, it could have been mistaken. You know, he could have just been mistaken. And then the government came back in rebuttal closing and said, no, he couldn't have been mistaken. You know, that's not what's at issue. You have to find that he was lying. You have to find he was lying and there was a government conspiracy, or you can't acquit Mr. Thompson. So if that answers your question, if there are no further questions, I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Well, to follow up on that, did defense counsel insinuate that Faulkner was lying, and that's why there should be an acquittal, because he was conveniently remembering things that helped the prosecution?
Your Honor, I think it's fair to say that there was some insinuation that he might have been lying. Yes, I think that's fair. Again, I think that defense counsel was posing different alternatives to the jury. Look, he might be lying, but also he could have just been mistaken.
You think both were presented? Okay. Thank you for your argument. You may reserve the balance.
Thank you.
Mr. Roberts, we'll hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Dustin Roberts. I'm a AUSA from the Western District of Arkansas. With respect to the three issues presented today, unlike Mr. Holt, the government maintains that there was not only sufficient evidence presented at trial, but there was overwhelming evidence. And not just in consideration of his statement made to law enforcement. In this case, there was a web-based conversation very typical of most online enticement of a minor cases. This included that the minor was sexually inexperienced, that it included the specific sexual acts that Mr. Thompson wanted to perform on the minor, included that they set up a meeting to engage in those sexual acts, and then following up on that plan, Mr. Thompson was arrested when he showed up at the meeting. Separate and apart from that is the statement to law enforcement, but even looking at the chat and the fact he showed up alone is not only significant or sufficient, it's overwhelming evidence. With respect to the prosecutorial misconduct, Mr. Thompson just fails to show his burden meet his burden under plain error review, given specifically the overwhelming level of evidence, even excluding, if you will, the so-called tainted testimony or tainted interview.
Counsel, but you're not conceding that there was misconduct. Am I right in my recollection?
That is correct, Your Honor, and I'm glad to answer that. The reason why the government is not conceding that there is improper questioning or argument in this case is because I saw no black letter law cited by Mr. Thompson that would indicate that just saying lying, regardless of the circumstance, or just arguing like it was argued, regardless of the circumstance, is improper. Instead, my understanding of the case law, it's more of a totality of the trial approach, as some of the questions presented to Mr. Holt.
How would the defendant ever be in a position to judge whether the witness for the prosecution was lying? Because that requires a state of mind.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, if the question is how would a defendant ever broach the topic that they're lying?
That's not the question. Not how would a defendant broach the topic. The question is, if the prosecutor's question to the defendant is, isn't the witness for the prosecution lying, or aren't you saying that the prosecution witness is lying, how is that ever a proper question? Because it requires knowledge of the state of mind of the witness for the prosecution.
I understand the question now, Your Honor, and what I would say to that is it depends on the direct examination that preceded the cross-examination question. In this specific case, the government's point is that the defendant testified not just to something that conflicted with the agent, meaning that he admitted that the minor was under 16, the one he intended to meet, whereas Mr. Thompson maintained he said adult woman. There was more here. One, Mr. Thompson testified that this interview was in fact recorded. That is problematic in that the agent testified that there was no recording in this case due to the batteries failing on the recording device. That implies right there that his credibility is in question. But he goes far beyond that, and this is kind of the most striking thing, I think, in this case, the one that stands out separate and apart from a lot of the cases Mr. Thompson cites, is that he stated to the effect, something to the effect of, well, I asked for an attorney, and Agent Faulkner then started asking me questions if I would consent. He specifically said that was not his understanding what's supposed to happen when he asked for an attorney. So now it becomes more of an ethical and legal question of what Special Agent Faulkner was doing.
Can't Special Agent Faulkner simply testify that that's not what happened without asking the defendant to comment on whether or not the agent's lying? I mean, that's the jury can make their decision after hearing all the evidence.
That is correct, Your Honor. In reflection, we would probably have done something like that to avoid this entire issue, but the fact...
You can always ask whether the witness for the prosecution is accurately conveying the facts without asking whether it's a lie. But your people wanted to get lying into the dialogue.
Well, prior to the lie question, the prosecutor, the AUSA, did confirm that Mr. Thompson understood the testimony before. She went over the testimony saying, you did hear Agent Faulkner say this. Again, the government's position is the reason why we're not conceding it, although I will admit this is a harder argument for the government, the clear part for the government is that Mr. Thompson cannot satisfy his burden in the prejudicial analysis by showing that that there was not otherwise substantial evidence and that there was no curative instruction.
You know, why don't you concede that which you can't defend, that it was improper argument? The only way you go home with a victory is that the evidence is overwhelming. Why shouldn't we apply the classic statement in Berger versus United States, striking foul blows is not permitted? Why shouldn't we try to keep the Western District of Arkansas? You are in the Western District, aren't you?
I am, yes, sir.
Why shouldn't we try to maintain the integrity of the prosecutorial function in the Western District of Arkansas rather than approving that which I think in your heart of, I'm not going to ask what's in your heart of hearts, but would you yourself make an argument like this in front of the jury? No. So maybe you would. Maybe you would. Maybe we shouldn't even ask that question. But.
Sir, the reason why we're not conceding, I just under the totality of this case did not see any...
Well, because you're under orders, never concede. Never concede if you can possibly avoid doing so.
Well, Your Honor, I believe there is a legitimate governmental concern or a legitimate concern just as a party that the Mr. Thompson's burden is to show all levels of prosecutorial misconduct, and it's just not clear to the government that, based on the case law, that without a very detailed look at the entire case, can you determine if a statement is improper? And that's my point on appeal. But to be very clear...
No, not only are you not conceding it, you're arguing it, arguing that what was done by the prosecutor was proper.
Well, Your Honor, I am given reasons why the actual cross-examination came down and happened. Now, Judge Colleton asked Mr. Holt on during his time for the reason why this court gets so many prosecutorial misconduct claims without objection. In this case, I would suggest to the court that it was because it would further highlight the implausible testimony of the defendant, of Mr. Thompson. There's a reason why you don't object in court, because sometimes it just makes things worse. In this case, I think we had so much overwhelming evidence. Looking at the online conversation alone, an officer puts on, as kind of stereotypical or typical rather, in online enticement case, an ad in Craigslist in this case, stating that they're looking for new friends, mature for my age, sick of drama. Mr. Thompson responds saying, "Hi, are you still looking?" The undercover says, "Yes, my name's Sky. I'm under 30, or I'm 13 years old. Hope that's okay." Mr. Thompson inquires, "What kind of friend are you looking for?" The UC says, "Any?" And then they proceed to ask, or Mr. Thompson proceeds to ask for pictures of the undercover, the purported 13-year-old minor. Now, to address Mr. Holt's argument about the 28-year-old female, now one of the pictures involved a filter in which it kind of masked the undercover officer with bunny ears and a bunny nose, which he stated in a trial was common for minors to use. But yeah, she was factually 28 years of age when she sent that. That was brought out in trial, was argued to the jury, and that specific those specific pictures were provided to the jury. Now, Mr. Thompson responded to this bunny picture by saying that she was beautiful. The undercover asked, "Are you okay with me being younger?" Kind of the hallmarks of under online investigation involving the enticement of a minor. Mr. Thompson asked, "What are you looking for? Do you party? Are you a cop?" He references drugs and alcohol, to which the undercover responds, "I'm homeschooled." Now, ultimately, the undercover said that they were good with weed, their words, and alcohol. But Mr. Thompson moves it on, saying, "Hey, please take what law enforcement calls a proof of life picture." Proof of life picture, basically three fingers being held up. To show that you're a real person. At this point, it transitions from email to text message. Now, this brings us to one of the big points Mr. Thompson makes with regard to sufficiency of the evidence, is that the fact that the conversation occurs in two phases, they claim is highly relevant. Because the minor identifies herself as 13 in the email portion, but not again during the text message portion. This, again, was argued to the jury, kind of runs afoul of the standard in sufficiency of the evidence, looking at everything in light most favorable to the verdict. But the argument, just for credibility or just for validity's sake, is that Mr. Thompson was presented with an individual who identified themselves as 13, asked for a picture, and when they moved to send him a picture, he just either forgot, mistook, got confused, or simply didn't care that he was chatting with a 13-year-old prior to that. That is a hard position to be in when you're in front of a jury, obviously. The U.S. v. Pearson case, evidence supporting guilt, need not preclude every other outcome other than guilt. But this kind of review of the facts of the evidence, Your Honor, it goes to the prosecutorial misconduct claims also, because the one of the gauges for prejudice, one of the factors, is the strength of the government's case outside this alleged tainted, in this case, interview. The conversation that occurred via email included, what do you do for fun? Mr. Thompson brings up sexual activity, inquires about the minor's sexual experience, which she overall responds is limited. Mr. Thompson brags about his sexual abilities. He asked for sexually explicit photos and or getting undressed via FaceTime. Then after the undercover says no, they start talking about meeting up for purposes of engaging in sex the next day. The undercover agrees that they will talk the next day. Then following day, the chats resume. They discuss sex. They discuss the fact that the purported minor was a virgin. Mr. Thompson offers to change that fact. He discussed pornography. And again, he makes a statement that he would not be disappointed unless she is a cop or something. One of the hallmarks of online enticement type cases. Mr. Thompson's argument with respect to the 28-year-old female, it was just presented to the jury. The defense has offered certain reasons or facts, but the jury is not required to believe him. This holds true with the argument that he believed she was an adult because she said she was okay with marijuana and alcohol. Quoting directly from from the transcript, a question was presented: why didn't you think it was a minor when she said she was homeschooled? He replied, because she replied that she was 420 friendly and okay with alcohol. Prosecutor responds, so what? And Mr. Thompson replied, well, that's an adult. A minor cannot purchase alcohol on their own. Your Honor, the statements that Mr. Thompson provided in court were just not credible, and they certainly don't satisfy his burden of showing insufficient evidence, and they certainly don't reflect that there was kind of a fair credibility analysis going on between Agent Faulkner and the defendant. Your Honor, I see that I've spent most of my time reviewing the facts, but some of the more outlandish statements that I want to make sure the court is aware of, the defendant testified that he didn't need to ask the undercover their age because he was convinced of the picture alone. He stated at one point that when he was interviewed, he responded with regard to who he was meeting. He said, the adult woman, without prompt. My favorite one is that the minors can't buy alcohol. Also, the prostitute question, there's nothing in the chat to support that. So overall, Your Honor, the government's point is that based on the strength of the government's case, the first two issues, Thompson cannot satisfy. And finally, I didn't get to it, but Thompson fails to meet his burden in showing the court abused its discretion with regard to the motion to compel. Thank you, Your Honor. All
right. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Holt, we'll hear from you in rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll probably address most of my time here. I don't have much, but to the fact that the evidence here was not as overwhelming as the government wishes that it had been. There was no recording of the interview that was conducted. So there's no smoking gun there regarding his purported confession. The task force officer who conducted the interview did not testify at trial. Agent Faulkner only testified to what Thompson had said during the interview after reviewing the report made by this other agent, by Agent Sears. There were plenty of of things that Mr. Thompson testified to that indicated that he did not necessarily believe that he was talking to a minor. She referred on about three different occasions to wanting to make him happy. Now, Mr. Thompson had been around the block a time or two, and he had had experience with prostitutes, and he testified, I think, very plausibly and very credibly that's the kind of thing that he would hear from prostitutes. Even the fact that he asked if she was a cop meant he was thinking about the fact that she might have been an adult who was involved in a prostitution sting. I don't think that is nearly as far-fetched as the government wants to make it out to be. And then also, I want to direct the court's attention to the I apologize for any mispronunciation of this, but the Chiziolka case, which is referenced in our sufficiency of the evidence argument. The court there said that one strains to understand why a police officer in a sting operation of this sort would send such a picture of an adult woman in her late 20s, which at best would serve to inject confusion, uncertainty, and suspicion as to the victim's age. In fact, it could surely have led Chiziolka to believe that Ashley was an adult pretending to be younger than she was. The unusual circumstances may even have led a defendant to suspect she was a police officer. So that right there shows that the fact that there were photos of a 28-year-old woman showed that the evidence was not conclusive. And I see my time's expired, so we would just ask the court to exercise its discretion to reverse and remand this to vacate the conviction, reverse and remand for a new trial.
All right. Thank you for your argument. Thank you to both counsel. The case is submitted. The court will file an opinion in due course.